I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to the Dan Wootton Interview, the podcast that brings some of the biggest names from around the world straight to your headphones. And this week, I welcome a band that is celebrating their 25th anniversary. It's Mikey, Shane, Keith, and Ronan from Boyzone. I caught up with the boys on their recent visit to London to talk about their huge years of success, marred, of course, by tragedy with the death of Stephen Gately, and why they've decided to make this their last ever album and tour. Plus, of course, they take on Shuffle, Delete, Repeat and reveal the five songs that mean the most to them, including a very special choice for Stephen. Remember, we've got loads more amazing stars in our back catalogue as well. Kirstie Alley and John Legend are the last two episodes. They have gone all around the world, so we've got lots of feedback on Kirstie's interview at the end of the show. So make sure you subscribe right now and you can listen back to all of those episodes. But first, let's go in-depth and personal. Here's Boyzone. Boyzone, welcome to my pod.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Do you know, this is weird for me because it's the first and last time I will ever interview Boyzone. So I've obviously spoken to you individually over the years, but never as a group.
Really?
Never.
Really?
No.
Wow.
No. Okay. And it's all over. Mm. Nearly.
Nearly, yeah. Nearly, yeah. Nearly. But this tour could go on for 6 years. We don't know yet.
Are you going to do an Elton John?
Yeah, absolutely. 300 gigs in 300 days.
No, it's definitely the beginning of the end, for sure. We know we have a clear year mapped out ahead of us. Whether we push past that or not, I don't know, but this is the final album for sure.
And tell me why you decided to make that decision, because it's quite a big call. You know, you're young men, you see people now go on and tour for so much longer, and also it's a big cash cow if you look at a band like the Rolling Stones, who are going on well into their 70s. So what made you decide this has to be it?
Well, initially, it was just all based around a 25th anniversary album, to be honest. Mm. But as that progress went on, I don't think there was a particular decision to say we were going to finish one day. But we all began to realise that, actually, you know what, everything is kind of going good for us with this 25-year anniversary, with all the promotion, with everything else that was to go with it. And it just kind of felt like the right thing to do, that, you know, if we're going to go out, let's go out in style, you know, rather than hang around for way too long and, you know, playing the shows that are half sold out and stuff like that, you know. I want to go out with a bang.
I love the idea of going out on top, because it's something that very few people in the entertainment industry are actually ever able to do.
Yeah,
because
some hang on till it gets embarrassing, and we wouldn't like to do that.
Absolutely.
Well, it all depends on what you call embarrassing, to the point of where if you're an artist, let me say. No, like if you're an artist and you believe in your craft and you want to hold on to who you are and what you do, then I don't care if you're playing to 10 people or 10,000 people, then I think you should be your creator, your own self, because you're only going to give that to yourself. No one's going to give it to you. So, but I think as a boy band and as a collective, as the boys call Boyzone, where we are happy to say 25 years is an amazing achievement. And we are happy to say, right, that's enough for us. It's hard enough to get us together, you know, for this album, let alone another one in the future. You know, we're all very, very busy with what we have. We're all very busy with what we do, different lives. And this last 25 years is a very solid goodbye. And it's a nice kind of clarity time in our own mind to be able to move forward as individuals, knowing that this is the end. We're not waiting for another couple of years and the record company to be saying, what are you doing? Should we make an album? Is this the right time? What are you doing? Right, like, that's you're kind of floating around in a nonsense state many, many times as a Boyzone group. But now we know what we're doing. This is it. This is signed, sealed, delivered. Thank you. Good night.
And Keith, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, when you think back to 90s boy bands, they have remarkable staying power compared to any other generation. You know, you've got the Backstreet Boys still going strong. You've obviously got lots of discussion about NSYNC. There's rumours that Westlife might come back together at some point soon. What was it about the 90s that was able to create this era of the boy band?
Well, I think the music business was a much different place back in the 90s. Back in the 90s, if people wanted your CD, they went into HMV or Virgin Megastore or whatever, and they bought a physical hard copy of your CD, your album, your single. These days, with the likes of Spotify and Apple Music and downloads and so forth, it's very difficult for a band of today to create a foundation like bands in the 90s were able to create. Back in the 90s, you recorded an album and you toured, you concert toured to sell the album. Mm. Nowadays, you basically sell the album to sell your concert dates because the music business has changed so much. There's 90% of the revenue of publishing royalties and record royalties are gone. Not the publishers so much as the record royalties. There's no money being made anymore. The record companies are down 90% of their finance. So the bands find it very difficult in today's world to create that foundation of a fan base to be able to continue ongoingly. Whereas we're very fortunate that we started in the 90s. We grinded it out. We started off playing in farm barns, in nightclubs. We built our way up then to play theatre halls. Then we built our way up to arena tours, and our fans grew with us and travelled with us. And that fan base is very, very loyal. And that is why today, 25 years later, as a boy band, you know, as we started as a boy band, we're still able to go and nearly set out an arena tour for next year. That fan base is so loyal because of that foundation. It's so much more difficult nowadays, like I say, to get that foundation. And the bands that you've mentioned, like the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Westlife, were a huge, huge part of the music business before it broke, before it changed, before it flipped upside down. And that gives them the right, basically, to come back with the fan base they have to be able to be as successful as they were years ago.
The Five. So now it's The Five, where each week I ask my guests about the five songs that mean the most to them. So it could be a song that inspired you to write and play music, or one that brings back special memories, or maybe a song you'd like to cover. So recently, Kirstie Alley, she chose Vivaldi because it whisks her back to Greece when she hears it. John Legend chose Curtis Mayfield. It was the soundtrack to his daughter's birth. And Camila Cabello singled out the soothing tones of John Mayer. So boys, because it's The Five, I thought that each of you could pick a track, and then maybe also you'd like to pick a song for Stephen Gately as well to bring the five songs. So Keith, should we kick off with you?
Well, sure. Let me see. What was my opinion for Stephen Gately would be that song he used to sing all the time in the bar at 3 a.m. fish are jumping and the cotton is free. Summertime for Steel.
Summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high.
And for myself, would have to be The Piano Man by Billy Joel.
Sing us a song, you're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight. Well, we're all in the mood for a melody, and you've got us feeling all right.
Shane, what is your choice?
My choice would be the record that Labyrinth and Emily Sunday did, Beneath You Beautiful. I think it's one of the most amazing records that's been released for a long, long time. Beautiful, 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 sentimental and touching record.
Let me see beneath your beautiful. Would you let me see beneath your perfect? Take it off now, girl. Take it off now, girl. I wanna see inside. Would you let me see beneath your beautiful tonight?
Mikey, what's your choice?
My personal favorite song of all time is One by U2.
You sang one love, one life, when it's one need. The night, one love.
choose a song for Stephen, I would choose Wonderful Life by Black. He loved that song very much.
Well, that's very appropriate, isn't it? Let's have a listen. And Ronan, what song completes Boyzone's vibe for you?
Well, I think this is for me and it's for the band, I think, because it was such a moment for us. But I think Father and Son, Cat Stevens, for me, it puts me back in me Nissan Micra, my brother, playing it on a cassette tape when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years of age going to school.
You were driving at 8 or 9?
I was, yeah. And it was just a very, very special song. It opened, it blew my mind, and it introduced me to Cat's music. And from there, I sang it at the audition for Boyzone, sang it with Boyzone, sang it with Cat. And it's just, it's been with me my whole life. It's just a very special song for me. And, you know, very poignant right now. My son headed off to Australia yesterday for a year. Very, very emotional time for me, my eldest boy. And that was, yeah, that song was in my head as he walked through the departure gate to the airport, and it's very, very special. Yeah,
that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was, it really was, as tough as they come.
Well, and that was the first Boyzone single that I bought.
Is
really?
It?
Yeah.
There you go.
It was good indeed, man. Back in Wellington, New
Did
Zealand.
You see the video for that song?
Yeah.
We were doing some very professional posing in that.
Bought the whole of ourselves.
Unrecognisable with the posing
and
we were doing.
If I remember correctly, we were performing it on Top of the Pops when Duster found out he was going to be a father.
Yeah, we had one mobile phone between the five of us, and we were sitting around the phone waiting on it to call. And when the phone rang, I found out.
You what?
You're going to be a daddy. And then we were, and it was ironic that we were performing Father and Son, because it wasn't supposed to be a single, it was only an album track. And on Top of the Pops, the only time you get to perform, or you used to be only get to perform on Top of the Pops, was if your album goes straight in at number one, and you can pick a random album track to perform. So it was just because the song was so meaningful to Ro that we decided it will never be an album track. It'd be great to perform this on Top of the Pops. And that afternoon, I found out I was going to be a daddy, and 9 months later, I was father of a son.
Yeah, there you go. And now,
and he's 22 now.
Jordan's 22, yeah.
That's the terrifying thing. Well, look, let's take a little listen to the Cat Stevens version and then the Boyzone version.
How can I try to explain? When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
Now, Ronan, you've been very open about the fact that it was your decision to end the band first time around in 99-2000. Did you have any doubts about it this time, given that you did regret that decision back then?
We all decided as a five-piece that we were going to take a break back in 1999, because we all wanted to get off for a while and just take a time out for ourselves and kind of figure out who we were as people. I was on a certain train, moving very, very fast, and I didn't want to get off. I was enjoying what I had as a solo artist. So yes, I didn't come back to the band, and it was my decision from that break to become a breakup, as such, I would say. I had absolutely no doubt. 2006, well, it was 2004 when we first saw each other again. Shane was on The Games, a TV show, that we all saw each other again. And there was the love that was in the room. It was a very special feeling that I can't explain. And it's something that the five of us share together, that bond. And we slowly started to talk then about getting back together again. It took us 3 years to make that happen. And then we came back together 2007. And there was no regrets whatsoever. Absolutely not. It was it's what we all wanted. Mm. And to rebuild those bridges the relationship was still the same. It was like nothing changed. And that was a very, very special thing for us and for me too.
So this time, why do you know that it's right to say this is the end of Boyzone forever?
We're a boy band. We started 25 years ago. I was 16 years of age. Mikey, the eldest at the time, 20. You were 21.
21, yeah.
Nobody knew what was going to happen. We had no idea what was in store for us. We worked very, very hard and we created something very special. I don't think any, well, shame, you know, some of us believed that it was going to last. Some of us didn't believe it was going to last. But to say that we'd still be here 25 years later and be through, you know, what we had been through, the loss of Stephen, the ups, the downs, our story has been unbelievable. And we're very, very grateful for what we've achieved and what we have. And we feel that 25 is a great number. You know, a quarter of a century for a boy band to be going is a long time. And we want to go gracefully and do it our way. Nobody else. We want to do it our way. So yeah, we're taking control, we're taking the reins, and we're saying this is what we want to do. Go out in a high, bring all our friends, get everybody involved and do this the way we want to do it. And it's going to take some time to get through that. It's going to be, you know, the next 12 months, it's going to, you know, be incredible. It's going to be heartbreaking. But we will have each other. We'll have this story, and that'll be that. Yeah, it just feels right.
Something to tell the grandkids.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me about the conversation. I mean, how did it happen? Did you sit down, the four of you, or was it something that happened on the phone or by email when you actually made the decision? What was the scenario?
Well, the scenario was we always said that we would get back together for the 25th anniversary album. Warner Music, our record company, you know, they were very good for recording a 25th anniversary album. We felt, having been in their studio and we were nearly finished this album, when we were kind of looking back at the songs that we had just recorded, we felt it's the best work that we've ever done.
Absolutely.
Shane kind of came up with the concept. Like we were saying earlier on, music has changed. It's all about Spotify and Apple Music. People don't buy an album now and listen to start to finish. They don't listen to the album tracks. They pick the songs they want off the album, which are usually the ones that the band pick as a single because they find it's the strongest song on the album. Shane came up with the concept, why do that? We all have different tastes in music. Why don't we all pick three songs each that we love, our type of music that we care about and we're passionate about, and put that on an album like a shuffle? So people will have an awful lot more to choose from than just album tracks. Shane's favourite three, Ronan's favourite three, mine, Mikey, so on. And when we finished that concept and we had our songs that we had chosen to go on the album, we felt it was the best work we've ever done. And like we said earlier on, we didn't want to milk it for everything it's worth. We didn't want to take the life out of it. We've been very fortunate that we've put arena tours on sale every time we've come back, and we've sold very, very well. This tour has sold very, very well. We want to go out with a bit of dignity and pride. We want to go out and say we've done the best job we can. We lasted up. We're remembered for as big and as successful as we were, and you know, we didn't go out failing at the end. And we all agreed that that's dignified, and that's a nice way to kind of say thank you and good night.
And was it hard to come to that decision collectively? Because, of course, one of the things in a band that is always so difficult, right, is that you have to make decisions collectively. And, you know, it does pull so many different bands apart. You've got to be on the same page. But it sounds like in this case,
but you it was easier when Steve was alive because it was five. So, you know, yeah, democracy would be three over two. But when it's four, it's difficult if it's a split decision. But ultimately, we talk it out. We find out what we feel is the most sensible way. Everybody listens to each other. And then we kind of, you know, digress then for a while and we figure out what way we want to go.
And did anyone have any doubts about this being?
Absolutely. I think we all did.
I think we all have doubts. Yeah. But we all know it's the right decision. I think the first time we heard it was we were doing like a promo video in a studio. We were playing a couple of the records and we sat and did an interview. And one of the old school interviewers from back in the Smash Hits day came in, and you know, she asked a question, and it's the first time we spoke it out loud as a united group, saying this is the end. And I, when we actually heard it, it was like, oh, that hurts. That hurt. Although we were talking about it in amongst ourselves,
it made it real.
You know, it made it real. Mm-hmm. We announced it. We said this is the end, and it was like, oh, dang. Mm-hmm. And I think from there, it's been getting the head around it, knowing that this is the right thing to do. And although that last gig, that last show is going to be horrible, it's going to be absolutely horrible.
There won't be a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, you know, and I think we're going to be so, no, the war's not regretful, but it's going to hurt, but we have to do it.
And where is the last show, do you know?
Gigs keep being added onto the tour all the time. We're looking at New Zealand, Australia, we're UAE, you know, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, India, Sri Lanka, up right at the moment.
Will you come back home though to perform
for the last time? It would be nice to finish doing a gig in Dublin.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It would be lovely. Dublin or London. I mean, London has been our boyzone's home. So Dublin or London would be a nice place to finish. I think you know.
I think you've got to do that. You've got to come home for your final performance. And as you say, Keith, I've been lucky enough to listen to five of the tracks from the album, and it is incredibly strong songs. You know, they are all great, great, great tunes that do cover different genres of music. And it's interesting as well, lots of big writers wanted to work with you for this album too. I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, but there's tracks from Ed Sheeran and Sam Smith that have been included on the album.
The Sam one didn't happen in the end. So the Ed Sheeran one, which was the single, obviously, because it was a great coup for us to get Ed involved.
I didn't know that was the song that he wrote.
Yeah,
great song.
It was great for us. I mean, he's the biggest artist in the world now, and luckily a friend so reached out and he produced this song, which has just been fantastic for us and a great kickoff to the album. Everywhere we went so far, it's been received very well. So yeah, that's very special.
No, it absolutely is. It's a really great, great song.
Yeah.
And was there emotion recording, knowing that this was the last time that all four of you would be in the studio together? Or is that how you do it? I mean, I know some bands do all of the recording individually.
I don't think we were completely decided
at that point
when we were doing the album that we were going to part. That decision came along later on when we had finished the work.
The emotional time in the studio really was when we came across the song with Stephen.
Yeah.
I mean, that was handed to us nearly 17 years later, you know.
And so tell me about this. What song is it and how did it all happen?
Well, it's a song that Stephen recorded for his solo career about 17 years ago. And I mean, to be honest, Mikey would probably answer this question better because he worked a lot more on it than I did.
Well, basically, there were Pete Kirtley, a producer who had worked with Stephen 17 years ago, they wrote a song called Dream. And Pete was moving house at the same time as we were recording the album. Now, somehow through the grapevine, he heard that we were doing the album and he came across an old DAT tape, a DAT tape, from years ago that he did with Stephen. Anyway, he forwarded it to the record company to see if they'd be interested in using it. They had to listen to it. It was 17 years old, so obviously it was a bit dated in production and that kind of stuff. But they had, you know, the idea that they would like to use it if there was any way possible. So I was asked to take it into studio. I did so. I stripped it down completely, kept his vocal was wonderful all the way through, but just basically rearranged the song, rewrote the lyrics and the melodies, counter melodies, all that stuff. And then the lads come into studio then as well. We finished it off. The record company were happy with it. We were all very happy with it, and it's made the album. But yeah, there was an emotional aspect to recording the vocals once we had the arrangement finished, because to hear Stephen's voice again on a song that we have never heard him sing before, I mean, it really was like he was back in the room with us. But as I was saying in a previous interview today, the irony of it is that, like, we've had a couple of albums out over the last few years. Like, we did a 20th year anniversary album, and this song never surfaced before, you know. So at a time when we also were deciding to finish the band, the most ironic fashion, that Stephen came forward. He was like, well, if you're breaking up, you're not doing it without me, you know? So, you know, it kind of completes the circle to have Stephen singing a great song on the album, you know?
Absolutely. No, it's so appropriate, isn't it? And I mean, it's quite crazy to think that it's now nearly been 10 years since Stephen's death. And of course, probably by the time that you do finish the tour, it will be a decade on. Yeah. And I mean, I know I'll never forget that night in 2009 when, you know, I got the call from Louis Walsh, who was just completely shell-shocked and devastated. And I remember speaking to you, Shane, later and later that night, and you just couldn't believe it. I mean, looking back now, nearly 10 years on, have you been able to cope and sort of understand that night and what happened?
Well, that night was just very, very strange. That's all I can say. It's a blur. We were completely numb. I remember walking through Dublin Airport on the first flight out the next morning.
Because you all flew out, didn't you? And Ronan, Shane, you were in
Keith
New York,
and
I think.
And Ronan was coming in from Chicago. And we really were just in a complete dream-like sense. And like, it was such a strange thing going through the airport security. The people were all very courteous to us and giving their sympathies and stuff like that. And we just couldn't take this in, you know, at all.
That was harder, though.
That was really hard.
You know, in a boy band growing up in the north side of Dublin when we first started, it wasn't the coolest thing to do. Guys our own age, whether it be jealousy or what or whatever, you know, they like to shout abuse at us from time to time. We were used to, if ever we saw a gang of guys going on a stag do in an airport or whatever, we'd kind of do a detour not to have to walk past them, because they'd usually fire abuse at us because of the style of band we were. You know, Irish people are very passionate about their rock-renowned culture with U2 and the Cranberries and Sinead O'Connor, and all of a sudden you have a boy band. It wasn't cool to start off with. So I remember walking through the airport with Mikey and Shane, and it was quite early in the morning, and I remember seeing a gang, a stag do, and all of, like, Stephen was all over breaking news all over the TVs in the airport, and there was a gang of about maybe 20 guys coming up on our right-hand side. And usually, like I say, we get a lot of abuse, but we were so upset, we were trying to hold ourselves together. I think none of us said it to each other, but we kind of all looked at each other and we kind of said, if these guys start on us, let's just have them. Right? Yeah. I think that was just a mutual kind of unsaid thought we had between us. And as we walked by, all the lads just gave us their sympathy and they were really, really nice. And that really threw us. That made us kind of, that put tears in our eyes even more so. And we were trying to kind of keep it together. We eventually got past them guys and we choked on ourselves for a bit, and then we went upstairs with Time to Kill, and Mikey went up to get some food and for the three of us, and Shane said, I'm going to get a few beers, and both of them, I said, I got us a table, and both of them came back in tears as if something else had happened, you know. And I said, what's up, what's happened? He goes, they wouldn't charge us a penny for any of the food or the drinks. Everybody was just
great,
so
support.
Nice.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. People were wonderful to us during that time. However, since then, it's 9 years later. It has been painful, emotional, all of those various things that happen to a person when they lose a loved one. But, you know, as they say, time is a healer. It's a healer of the scar tissue, but the scar is always there, you know. But we do our best in our shows, and even when we're together every time, there's always a sense of Stephen's spirit and character remains with us. And on stage, we also make sure that we dedicate a section of the show to Stephen as well. Just wouldn't feel right to do a show without that.
And I mean, I wonder if, listening to you talk about that experience, if it was the first time that you guys maybe realised how much Boyzone as a band meant, especially to Ireland, because that day of his funeral, you know, 6 days later, that Saturday, Dublin just came to a complete standstill. Mm-hmm. And it was like the whole city and the whole country were marking his life. And of course, you guys had that very emotional night in the church with his body. I mean, take me back to that day now, and it must have meant a lot to see that reaction.
I think we were all blown away.
I think we were all really caught off guard is probably the closest I can get to it. Now, I'm an Irish man, I'm very proud of it. But in Ireland, you know, as Keith was saying earlier on, you know, rock music was the main thing. Pop bands were not taken very seriously. So sometimes in Ireland we felt that, you know, that we weren't taken very seriously. But when it came to the day of Stephen's funeral, not only the whole nation, but like everybody where Stephen grew up, Like the locals got in and, you know, like cut the grass and painted the fences all around the church and the area and tidied up absolutely everything. The police force were in full control and support of everything and any decisions that we wanted to make on the day. I mean, we were in the middle of such grief, but also so proud that our nation and our city, Dublin, had pulled together so much for us that it really weakened us emotionally. It made us emotional to see that response because we hadn't been used to that response up until that time.
But to be proud of that moment has to be given to Steel, because Steel was one of the first pop stars ever to come out about his sexuality, and the torture and the time he went through at that time of coming out, not knowing what way the fans were going to react, not knowing what kind of support he was going to get, how negative or positive it was going to be. It ended up being the most positive thing that ever happened in his life. And to go from being that scared of coming out to have come out to that positive reaction, and then to see the reaction that people and the respect that people had for Stephen as his persona and himself, when they threw the white roses in front of all the cars on the way to the church, it was I was devastated, but I was so proud for him because I knew he'd be looking down going, oh my God, that's all I wanted was acceptance. You know?
And if I may also just quickly add to that, he had the equivalent of a state funeral in Ireland. That's what he had.
Absolutely.
You know, and it was, that's a legacy and a massive eye-opener to the what he contributed to his friends, family, local area and country and the world.
But Keith, I'm glad you mentioned his trailblazing ability because, you know, for me, growing up as a gay teenager in New Zealand and hearing on the news, I really clearly remember it on the radio news bulletin that Stephen Gailey had come out as gay. It was a big, big moment, and it's a moment that obviously started this very, very long path. And I think we're pretty close to being there in the pop industry, but not totally all the way, because some people still do feel that they have to stay in the closet. But, you know, it did start changing the conversation about sexuality in pop music.
It was a game changer, really, within the industry, wasn't it?
It was.
You know?
Because before then, there would have been a feeling by record company executives that if one of the members of a band came out, it would be a commercial disaster. Yeah. And it wasn't.
Louis Walsh himself spent most of his time creating and spinning stories about Stephen going out with Posh Spice and Steve. Any girl that came on the scene, oh, that's Stephen's new girlfriend. Yeah. We'll have that in the press in the morning. He spent his life trying to convince people that Stephen was straight. He spent his life trying to tell us not to have girlfriends. You know what I mean? But really, people didn't mind.
Yeah.
It was okay to be human in the in the pop industry. People still liked you, you know? But Stephen was miserable about, at the time, his life was just not enjoyable for him. And then the change in his personality when he realised he was getting that support from his family, from the close friends that he'd never come out to. And then the world. Elton John reached out to him and helped him out. A lot of other gay kind of icons in the business reached out to him and helped him out. And Stephen, now he gradually got camper. The more people were understanding of him, he got camper and camper. And he was at the happiest time of his life when he passed.
Yeah.
You know, see, he went out on top. He went out a happy, happy man. You know, and that's an awful lot. That's a positive in a very negative story.
Yeah, actually, maybe that choice of song of his, the song "Wonderful Life," maybe that's why it was one of his favourites prior to coming out. A lot of significance in the lyrics of that song to maybe how he was feeling pre coming out. You know.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Shuffle, delete, repeat.
This is where you have to choose between Boyzone songs in different categories. So we're going to kick off with Boyzone ballads. Yeah. And your choices are Love Me For A Reason from 1994. This was obviously your first UK hit, peaked at number two. Baby, Can I Hold You? Peaked at number two as well, from 1997. You can say, baby, baby, can I hold you tonight? Baby, if I told you the right words, ooh, at the right time, you'd be mine. And No Matter What, your biggest selling single here, and actually the best selling single by any Irish act in the last 20 years, obviously from 1998.
I can't deny what I believe. I can't be what I'm not. I know I'll love forever. I know no matter what.
So out of those three iconic Boyzone ballads, which would you shuffle? Which would you delete and which would you put on repeat?
Whoa. Is that a question individually or do you want just one of us?
I think collectively you're going to have to
decide. Well, I think we'd all delete no matter what, I think, would we? Out of the three?
Well, we'd like to repeat no matter what and have the biggest sale. Yeah, that size obviously was the biggest thing. But in terms of
listening to it.
Listening to it and how much we're over it, we would probably delete.
Yeah, we'd probably delete no matter what. Yeah. We'd probably shuffle Love Me For A Reason.
Yeah. And repeat Baby Can I Help.
I agree.
Perfect. Now, Boyzone bangers, guys. So your choices here are So Good from 1995. That was number three in the UK. We're gonna be so good. Picture of You from 1997, obviously featured in Mr. Bean, the movie, and also a number two hit. And then your comic relief single, When the Going Gets Tough, from 1999, a UK number one. Ooh. Out of those bangers, which would you shuffle, which would you delete, and which would you repeat?
So Good.
Yeah, me too.
Delete So Good, yeah.
That we'd have, even though we'll probably do that on the next tour, we'll have to
delete it anyway.
Yeah. Delete it for now.
Shuffle, When Going Gets Tough.
Yeah.
And repeat Picture of You.
Yeah.
Like that.
Now, you mentioned Louis Walsh, so I have to ask, what is the status of your relationship with Louis today? Because I know it's been topsy-turvy over the years, but he did form you. So I guess your success, or at least the success of you coming together, has to be
credited. We always give Louis the credit for putting us together and for our success. We always say thank you to Louis. Some of us have a better relationship with him than others. But you know Louis as well as we do. I mean, he's a character. He's unpredictable. He'll come out with some crazy stuff. He is
totally unpredictable.
Totally unpredictable. You can meet him for lunch one day and have 4 hours of gossip and great fun, and the next day he's quoted in the papers for slagging you off and calling you all the names under the sun from absolutely nowhere. But when you know him, you get to understand him, you get to accept it. You either like it, lump it, or hate it, whatever way. But Louis is Louis, and when you know him, you know him.
And to add to that, we wouldn't be sitting here right now if it wasn't for him.
Ronan,
How are you and Louis these days? Because I know it's been.
I don't have any relationship with Louis whatsoever. I haven't seen the guy in years. But like Mick says, I don't think Boyzone would be here today if it wasn't for what, you know, the fight that Louis put up for us when everybody else in Ireland laughed and said, you know, there won't be an Irish boy band. Louis was the only one who fought for us and believed in us and did whatever it took to get Boyzone out of Ireland on the Smash Hits tour on the UK so that we could then come back to Ireland and play sellout shows all around the country. So, you know, we owe Louis that, and I will always give him that.
Why?
What we did after that was up to the five of us, because we were left we were left alone to then go out into the big bad world and figure it out for ourselves. We dealt with the labels and, you know, with everybody that we went with, who, you know, travelled globally, and it was up to the five of us, and that is down to the five of us. Yeah.
And why do you think, Ronan, your personal relationship with disintegrated with him? Because in the past, you know, you've said he tried to ruin you, and some of the things he has said about you publicly have been beyond harsh.
I don't really want to get into a slagging match with Louis, because we've done all of that. I wish him the absolute best in his life. And, you know, like Keith said, one day you meet him and he's your best friend, the next day he doesn't know who you are. And it's the guy he is. You never know what version of Louis you're going to get. I had a lot of love for Louis. You know, I had a lot of respect for him. I looked up to him as a mentor and I learned a lot from him. And what happened is very tough, really, because, you know, he let me down. And, you know, that's that, and that's the bottom line. So, you know, Louis can say this and say that. One day he'll say you're the best singer in the world. The next day he'll say you're not even the best singer in the band. And that's, you know, that's the truth.
Probably John Lennon line.
Yeah. You know, so you take it all with a pinch of salt. I wish him the best. I hope that he's happy. That's the most important thing.
First. Now, guys, this is quick fire, so I just want you to think of, each of you to think of the first time something happened. So,
be careful.
Your first celebrity crush.
Wendy James.
Kylie Minogue.
Beth from Neighbours, also known as Natalie Imbruglia.
Meg Ryan, maybe? Yeah.
Your first kiss.
Oh, what was her name?
An English girl called Elizabeth. That's all I remember.
Oh, you were very intercontinental, weren't you?
When I was seven.
You were seven? Yeah. Early started.
You started early, didn't you? Well,
couldn't tell you. I couldn't have no memory of that.
Fish called Wanda.
I'm always on time.
No memory of that.
I was with you.
Was
you? Fish called Wanda.
He was with me. He knows more than me.
And curly hair.
She'd curly hair. That's good enough.
No, she'd curly teeth.
Curly teeth.
Long back curly teeth.
And your first car.
Car.
Fiat 127.
Vauxhall Astra. Opel Astra in Ireland. Yeah.
Escort RS.
Mine was a Mark 1 Golf GTI.
Last. This is the lasts. Okay, so the last text message you sent.
Shit. On my phone.
I sent the text message asking my wife to send me the packet of substitute rice, which is made from Super Greens, so I could show it to Shane so he could get his wife to buy it for himself.
Well, that's the exact, and that's the last text I sent to my wife saying, Keith just sent me this, can you please get it for me? So there's only in there lying on the bed in there we did it.
Oh, come on, Mikey, something more interesting than
well,
that,
actually,
please.
My last text was also to my wife. She's just boarded a plane that's delayed in today's stormy weather, and it was just, have a safe journey, I love you, talk to you later. So there you go. How things have changed.
Yeah.
The last time you cried?
Last night at the airport. Seeing my 19-year-old son off to Australia.
About a week and a half ago, where my daughter, Mia, kind of has come from a very tough place, I suppose, to make it to her graduation of her of school, which is something we never thought we'd see, and I'm very proud of her, and there was a tear in my eye that night.
I think the last time I cried hard was when, I came out of the Big Brother house, and that was in January, and I saw my kids. And I cried hard then, because, we love.
Yeah, my last time was January as well. I lost my mother, unfortunately, at Christmas time. So I was holding all that stuff in. And then I was at home one day in the studio alone, and boom, the gates opened.
Mm. Oh, God, how horrible. Massive condolences. That's one of the worst possible moments, isn't it? And the last time you Googled yourself?
Years and years ago. Probably before Google was even invented.
It was Yahoo back then.
Yeah.
been a while.
Well, we're so old, we have to go to Yahoo to find her.
Yeah, yeah. So we're not on Google.
Google's too recent for us.
Now, of course, we look at you today, the four of you, and you're married, and you have great families, and you're solid men. But, you know, that pressure of the pressure cooker of boy band fame is incredibly difficult. And at the time, there are a lot of battles with alcohol and dealing with fame, which can really screw people up. So what do you think it was about you guys as a band that allowed you to come through that, and for that addiction or that depression or that paranoia to not overtake your lives?
I think, you know, we all are going to have definitely a certain take on our own lives on that, to certain 25 years of that journey. And I think personally, I still battle with making sense of the world, going and standing on stage in front of X amount of thousands of people and coming home and picking up dog shit, you know? Let's be real about unreal and real. And I still battle with alcohol. I still battle with being sober and being drunk. And should I have a glass of wine before I go on stage, or should I be sober before I go on stage? Which will I enjoy most? Should, you know, it, like, I think as a human, just trying to live and survive on this earth, nothing is easy. Being a dad, you know, being a husband, and just trying to pay any bills like any man. I don't think just being a pop star makes you any more worthy of being an alcoholic. I think pressures of life is very difficult for a lot of people. We are on a different pedestal for sure, or a different platform, or perhaps we're more exposed in many ways as the public look upon you. But yeah, I think we're under a lot of pressure like anybody else is out there, and continuously so.
Absolutely. But it didn't, I guess it didn't destroy you though, which fame can do. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen this week, for example, the publication of Lily Allen's book. And it's like, when I read that stuff, it's like, gosh, actually, being famous is hell. It's what people crave. But then the way that it destroys and plays with your mind is hell.
There is a poison chalice element about success. You know, as a youngster, well, all of us been interested in music, and you know, that's the pinnacle of your motivation and your ambition is to make it big. And what's making it big? It's seeking or achieving the approval of those that you consider, you know, worthy, whatever line of business you're in. And we were so young to become so successful that it was difficult. It's a real mind bender, you know, especially when you're younger. And we used alcohol a lot, you know, every evening, really, after a day's work. We'd go to the bar and have a few beers. And for the first 6-7 years or whatever, it was just a non-stop kind of train of trains, planes and automobiles. So intense, the environment. And you're under constant public scrutiny, that if your mind isn't strong enough, and mine certainly wasn't, that you're slowly but surely picked apart until you're looking at a version of yourself in the mirror that you no longer recognize from the person who first was interested in music. So when you're faced with that, there's a journey to a journey of self-discovery begins. And that can be torturous, and that can be painful. There is a way out of that. I thankfully achieved that way out of that. But yes, it fame comes with its poisons.
And perhaps looking back, actually, that break, that time apart, was maybe the best thing that ever happened to
absolutely
you.
Absolutely was.
Because actually, if you'd stayed together at that time in the absolute frenzied level
somebody
of fame,
somebody would have exploded sooner or other.
Yeah. I think though, in a short, quick answer to that question, growing up on the north side of Dublin in a very working class environment with our Irish mammies, they kept us very grounded. So there might have been a time that we might have flown too high, but we were as soon as we got back home to Dublin, we were grounded quite quickly. Yeah. Our mothers had a huge influence in our lives, and we never wanted to disrespect them, and we never ever wanted to kind of not make them proud. And we had that worry. So that kind of, those moments when you have a choice, sliding doors, you know, I think our grounding and our upbringing gave us that strength.
Yeah. Well, finally, I mean, who would have thought that this band, who, as you said, right in those early days of 1993, was considered a laughing stock in Ireland, would go on to have this success and still be together, releasing an album 25 years later. It really is an incredible story.
It proves that dreams can come true if you work hard enough at them. But sometimes be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it.
And you've got to be in it for the right reason.
You have.
Absolutely.
We can't wait to get back on stage in the arenas next year. We're going to have a great time.
Can't wait for that.
But now that we are older and hopefully a little wiser as well, I mean, we deal with this business in a very casual manner now. You know, we're all very settled in ourselves and our families and that kind of stuff. So, you know, as the lad said, like, we're bursting with joy, really, to get out there in front of the audience next year and tour the whole world and have a great time doing it. One last hurrah.
Well, boys, my first interview with you and my last. Oh, it has been emotional.
That's a pity, because it's been one of our best ever. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for an incredible 25 years.
Thank you.
Thanks a million.
What a fascinating and emotional interview, actually. It was very interesting watching Ronan in particular when the guys were speaking about Stephen Gailey. Ronan, of course, was very, very close to him. They were best friends, and his eyes just welled up, and he was looking out the window the whole time, because even 9 years on, clearly his loss is just so painful and so real. But it was also really intriguing to me just hearing their total honesty about what a quarter of a century in showbiz does to someone, and very honest about how they still battle in some ways to keep it together, and quite how hard a decision it was for them to say, this is it, we've done 25 years, there's not another album, there's not another tour, we are going to split up. Very, very few pop acts ever get the choice about how they end their careers. Because, you know, as I say, touring and releasing albums remains a cash cow. But I have huge respect for the decision that they've made. I think that actually it's a big deal to be able to say, we're finishing on a high. And as Mikey says, they're not going to be embarrassing themselves on stage in their 70s. So well done, Boyzone. And I really wish them the best of luck. But of course, my last interview on the podcast was with the Chairs legend, Kirsty Alley. You can listen to it right now if you subscribe. It's in our back catalogue for free. That interview, where she made so many revelations about her A-list co-stars, including her love for John Travolta and Patrick Swayze and Woody Harrelson, well, it was reported all around the world this week. We've had lots of feedback as well. Lisa Appleton said, great interview. You handle controversy well, like a violin. Shazza Lockster wrote to say, Kirsty is an absolute legend. I love the fact that she gets the British humour. I hope she comes back a lot more and does more interviews, as she's so interesting to listen to. Well, Shazza, she did say she does want to spend more time in the UK, actually. Caroline Lambert, welcome to the pod. She said, how have I only just realised you've got a podcast, Dan? First time, I'm looking forward to the train commute to work. Well, it's excellent to have you here. Luke Houston, he said, Kirsty is so down to earth. She doesn't think she's a star, even though she totally is. She's just like the girl next door, and that's what makes me like her more. I couldn't have put it better myself, actually. Perfect note to end. Thank you so much for all of your feedback. Of course, you can find me on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Just search for Dan Wootton, and you'll hear more about the podcast that we have coming up. But for now, make sure you subscribe and you'll get our next interview absolutely free. And I'll be back very soon for another A-list interview.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.